Tessa the D'Urbervilles, a pure woman. Phase the First, the Maiden, I 11. I on an evening in the latter part of May a middle-aged man was walking homeward from Shaston to the village of Marlott, in the adjoining vale of Blakemore, or Blackmore. The pair of legs that carried him were rickety, and there was a bias in his gait which inclined him somewhat to the left of a straight line. He occasionally gave a smart nod, as if in confirmation of some opinion, though he was not thinking of anything in particular. An empty egg basket was slung upon his arm, the nap of his hat was ruffled, a patch being quite worn away at its brim where his thumb came in taking it off. Presently he was met by an elderly parson astride on a gray mare, who, as he rode, hummed a wandering tune. "Good night, T," said the man with the basket.
"Good night, Sir John," said the parson.
The pedestrian, after another pace or two, halted, and turned round. "Now, sir, begging your pardon, we met last market day on this road about this time, and I said good night, and you made reply good night, Sir John, as now."
"I did," said the parson.
"And once before that, near a month ago."
"I may have."
"Then what might your meaning be in calling me Sir John these different times, when I be plain Jack Durbeyfield, the haggler?" The parson rode a step or two nearer.
"It was only my whim," he said, and, after a moment's hesitation, "it was on account of a discovery I made some little time ago, whilst I was hunting up pedigrees for the new county history. I'm Parson Tringham, the antiquary, of Stagfoot Lane. Don't you really know, Durbeyfield, that you are the lineal representative of the ancient and knightly family of the D'Urbervilles, who derive their descent from Sir Pagan D'Urberville, that renowned knight who came from Normandy with William the Conqueror, as appears by Battle Abbey roll?"
"Never heard it before, sir."
"Well, it's true. Throw up your chin a moment, so that I may catch the profile of your face better. Yes, that's the D'Urberville nose and chin, a little debased. Your ancestor was one of the 12 knights who assisted the Lord of Estermavela in Normandy in his conquest of Glamorganshire. Branches of your family held manors over all this part of England, their names appear in the pipe rolls in the time of King Stephen. In the reign of King John one of them was rich enough to give a manor to the Knights Hospitallers, and in Edward II's time your forefather Brian was summoned to Westminster to attend the great council there. You declined a little in Oliver Cromwell's time, but to no serious extent, and in Charles II's reign you were made Knights of the Royal Oak for your loyalty. Aye, there have been generations of Sir Johns among you, and if knighthood were hereditary, like a baronetcy, as it practically was in old times, when men were knighted from father to son, you would be Sir John now.
Ye don't say so. In short," concluded the parson, decisively smacking his leg with his switch, "there's hardly such another family in England."
"Daze my eyes, and isn't there?" said Durbeyfield. "And here have I been knocking about, year after year, from pillar to post, as if I was no more than the commonest feller in the parish. And how long had this news about me been knowed, Parson Tringham?"
The clergyman explained that, as far as he was aware, it had quite died out of knowledge, and could hardly be said to be known at all. His own investigations had begun on a day in the preceding spring when, having been engaged in tracing the vicissitudes of the D'Urberville family, he had observed Durbeyfield's name on his wagon, and had thereupon been led to make inquiries about his father and grandfather till he had no doubt on the subject. "At first I resolved not to disturb you with such a useless piece of information," said he. "However, our impulses are too strong for our judgments sometimes. I thought you might perhaps know something of it all the while."
"Well, I have heard once or twice, 'tis true, that my family had seen better days afore they came to Blackmore. But I took no notice out, thinking it to mean that we had once kept two horses where we now keep only one. I've got a old silver spoon, and a old graven seal at home, too, but, Lord, what's a spoon and seal? And to think that I and these noble D'Urbervilles were one flesh all the time. 'Twas said that my GRT grandfer had secrets, and didn't care to talk of where he came from. And where do we raise our smoke, now, Parson, if I may make so bold? I mean, where do we D'Urbervilles live?"
"You don't live anywhere. You're extinct, as a county family.
That's bad."
"Yes, what the mendacious family chronicles call extinct in the male line, that is, gone down, gone under."
"Then where do we lie?"
"At Kingspear's up Greenhill, rows and rows of you in your vaults, with your effigies under perbic marble canopies. And where be our family mansions and estates?"
"You haven't any."
"Oh? No lands neither?"
"None, though you once had them in abundance, as I said, for your family consisted of numerous branches. In this county there was a seat of yours at Kingspear, and another at Sherton, and another in Mill Pond, and another at Lulstead, and another at Wellbridge, And shall we ever come into our own again?
Ah, that I can't tell.
And what had I better do about it, sir?
Asked Durbeyfield, after a pause.
Oh, nothing, nothing, except chasten yourself with the thought of how are the mighty fallen. It is a fact of some interest to the local historian and genealogist, nothing more. There are several families among the cottagers of this county of almost equal luster. Good night. But you'll turn back and have a quart of beer why me on the strength out, pass in Tringham? There's a very pretty brew and tap at the Pure Drop, though, to be sure, not so good as at Rolliver's.
No, thank you, not this evening, Durbeyfield. You've had enough already. Concluding thus, the parson rode on his way, with doubts as to his discretion in retailing this curious bit of lore. When he was gone, Durbeyfield walked a few steps in a profound reverie, and then sat down upon the grassy bank by the roadside, depositing his basket before him. In a few minutes a youth appeared in the distance, walking in the same direction as that which had been pursued by Durbeyfield. The latter, on seeing him, held up his hand, and the lad quickened his pace and came near.
Boy, take up that basket. I want 'ee to go on an errand for me. The lath-like stripling frowned.
Who be you, then, John Durbeyfield, to order me about and call me boy? You know my name as well as I know yours.
Do you?
That's the secret, that's the secret. Now obey my orders, and take the message I'm going to charge ye why.
Well, Fred, I don't mind telling you that the secret is that I'm one of a noble race, it has been just found out by me this present afternoon, PM and as he made the announcement, Durbeyfield, declining from his sitting position, luxuriously stretched himself out upon the bank among the daisies. The lad stood before Durbeyfield, and contemplated his length from crown to toe.
Sir John Durbeyfield, that's who I am, continued the prostrate man. That is if knights were baronets, which they be. 'Tis recorded in history all about me.
Dost know of such a place, lad, as Kingsbere sub Greenhill?
Ease. I've been there to Greenhill Fair.
Well, under the church of that city there lie, 'tisn't a city, the place I mean, least twice twodden when I was there, 'twas a little one-eyed, blinking sort of place.
Never you mind the place, boy, that's not the question before us. Under the church of that there parish lie my ancestors, hundreds of them, in coats of mail and jewels, in GRT lead coffins weighing tons and tons. There's not a man in the county of South Wessex that's got grander and nobler skeletons in his family than I.
Oh? Now take up that basket, and go on to Marlott, and when you've come to the Pure Drop Inn, tell him to send a horse and carriage to me immediately, to carry me home. And in the bottom of the carriage they be to put a noggin of rum in a small bottle, and chalk it up to my account. And when you've done that go on to my house with the basket, and tell my wife to put away that washing, because she needn't finish it, and wait till I come home, as I've news to tell her. As the lad stood in a dubious attitude, Durbeyfield put his hand in his pocket, and produced a shilling, one of the chronically few that he possessed.
Here's for your labor, lad. This made a difference in the young man's estimate of the position.
Yes, Sir John.
Thank ye.
Anything else I can do for ye, Sir John?
Tell him at home that I should like for supper,
well, lamb's fry if they can get it, and if they can't, black pot, and if they can't get that, well chitterlings will do.
Yes, Sir John.
The boy took up the basket, and as he set out the notes of a brass band were heard from the direction of the village.
What's that? Said Durbeyfield.
Not on account of I?
'Tis the women's club walking, Sir John.
Why, your dater is one of the members.
To be sure, I'd quite forgot it in my thoughts of greater things.
Well, vamp on to Marlott, will ye, and order that carriage, and maybe I'll drive round and inspect the club.
The lad departed, and Durbeyfield lay waiting on the grass and daisies in the evening sun. Not a soul passed that way for a long while, and the faint notes of the band were the only human sounds audible within the rim of blue hills. To the village of Marlott lay amid the northeastern undulations of the beautiful vale of Blakemore, or Blackmore, aforesaid, an engirdled and secluded region, for the most part untrodden as yet by tourist or landscape painter, though within a 4 hours' journey from London. It is a vale whose acquaintance is best made by viewing it from the summits of the hills that surround it, except perhaps during the droughts of summer. An unguided ramble into its recesses in bad weather is apt to engender dissatisfaction with its narrow, tortuous, and miry ways. This fertile and sheltered tract of country, in which the fields are never brown and the springs never dry, is bounded on the south by the bold chalk ridge that embraces the prominences of Hambledon Hill, Balborough, Nettlecombe Tout, Dogbury, Highstoy, and Bubdown. The traveller from the coast,
who, after plodding northward for a score of miles over calcareous downs and cornlands, suddenly reaches the verge of one of these escarpments, is surprised and delighted to behold, extended like a map beneath him, a country differing absolutely from that which he has passed through. Behind him the hills are open, the sun blazes down upon fields so large as to give an unenclosed character to the landscape, the lanes are white, the hedges low and plashed, the atmosphere colorless. Here, in the valley, the world seems to be constructed upon a smaller and more delicate scale, the fields are mere paddocks, so reduced that from this height their hedgerows appear a network of dark green threads overspreading the paler green of the grass. The atmosphere beneath is languorous, and is so tinged with azure that what artists call the middle distance partakes also of that hue, while the horizon beyond is of the deepest ultramarine. Arable lands are few and limited, with but slight exceptions the prospect is a broad rich mass of grass and trees, mantling minor hills and dales within the major. Such is the Vale of Blackmoor. The district is of historic, no less than of topographical interest. The Vale was known in former times as the Forest of White Hart, from a curious legend of King Henry III's reign, in which the killing by a certain Thomas de Lalande of a beautiful white hart which the king had run down and spared, was made the occasion of a heavy fine. In those days, until comparatively recent times, the country was densely wooded. Even now, traces of its earlier condition are to be found in the old oak copses and irregular belts of timber that yet survive upon its slopes, and the hollow trunk trees that shade so many of its pastures. The forests have departed, but some old customs of their shades remain. Many, however, linger only in a metamorphosed or disguised form. The May Day dance, for instance, was to be discerned on the afternoon under notice, in the guise of the club revel, or club walking, as it was there called. It was an interesting event to the younger inhabitants of Marlott, though its real interest was not observed by the participators in the ceremony. Its singularity lay less in the retention of a custom of walking in procession and dancing on each anniversary than in the members being solely women. In men's clubs such celebrations were, though expiring, less uncommon, but either the natural shyness of the softer sex, or a sarcastic attitude on the part of male relatives, had denuded such women's clubs as remained, if any other did, or this their glory and consummation. The Club of Marlott alone lived to uphold the local serialia. It had walked for hundreds of years, if not as benefit club, as votive sisterhood of some sort, and it walked still. The bandit ones were all dressed in white gowns, a gay survival from old-style days, when cheerfulness and Maytime were synonyms, days before the habit of taking long views had reduced emotions to a monotonous average. Their first exhibition of themselves was in a processional march of two and two round the parish. Ideal and real clashed slightly as the sun lit up their figures against the green hedges and creeper-laced house fronts, for, though the whole troop wore white garments, no two whites were alike among them. Some approached pure blanching, some had a bluish pallor, some worn by the older characters, which had possibly lain by folded for many a year, inclined to a cadaverous tint, and to a Georgian style. In addition to the distinction of a white frock, every woman and girl carried in her right hand a peeled willow wand, and in her left a bunch of white flowers. The peeling of the former, and the selection of the latter, had been an operation of personal care. There were a few middle-aged and even elderly women in the train, their silver wiry hair and wrinkled faces, scourged by time and trouble, having almost a grotesque, certainly a pathetic, appearance in such a jaunty situation. In a true view, perhaps, there was more to be gathered and told of each anxious and experienced one, to whom the years were drawing nigh when she should say, "I have no pleasure in them," than of her juvenile comrades. But let the elder be passed over here for those under whose bodices the life throbbed quick and warm. The young girls formed, indeed, the majority of the band, and their heads of luxuriant hair reflected in the sunshine every tone of gold, and black, and brown. Some had beautiful eyes, others a beautiful nose, others a beautiful mouth and figure, few, if any, had all. A difficulty of arranging their lips in this crude exposure to public scrutiny, an inability to balance their heads, and to dissociate self-consciousness from their features, was apparent in them, and showed that they were genuine country girls, unaccustomed to many eyes. And as each and all of them were warmed without by the sun, so each had a private little sun for her soul to bask in, some dream, some affection, some hobby, at least some remote and distant hope which, though perhaps starving to nothing, still lived on, as hopes will. They were all cheerful, and many of them merry. They came round by the pure draw-pin, and were turning out of the high road to pass through a wicket gate into the meadows, when one of the women said, "The Lord." Why, Tess Derbyfield, if there isn't thy father riding home in a carriage. A young member of the band turned her head at the exclamation. She was a fine and handsome girl, not handsomer than some others, possibly, but her mobile peony mouth and large innocent eyes added eloquence to color and shape. She wore a red ribbon in her hair, and was the only one of the white company who could boast of such a pronounced adornment. As she looked round, Derbyfield was seen moving along the road in a chaise belonging to the Pure Drop, driven by a frizzle-headed brawny damsel with her gown sleeves rolled above her elbows. This was the cheerful servant of that establishment, who, in her part of factotum, turned groom and ostler at times. Derbyfield, leaning back, and with his eyes closed luxuriously, was waving his hand above his head, and singing in a slow recitative, "I've got a GRT family vault at Kingspear, and knighted forefathers in lead coffins there." The clubbists tittered, except the girl called Tess, in whom a slow heat seemed to rise at the sense that her father was making himself foolish in their eyes. "He's tired, that's all," she said hastily, "and he has got a lift home, because our own horse has to rest today." "Bless thy simplicity, Tess," said her companions. "He's got his market niche. Ha ha. Look here, I won't walk another inch with you, if you say any jokes about him," Tess cried, and the color upon her cheeks spread over her face and neck. In a moment her eyes grew moist, and her glance drooped to the ground. Perceiving that they had really pained her, they said no more, and order again prevailed. Tess's pride would not allow her to turn her head again, to learn what her father's meaning was, if he had any, and thus she moved on with the whole body to the enclosure where there was to be dancing on the green. By the time the spot was reached she has recovered her equanimity, and tapped her neighbor with her wand and talked as usual. Tess Derbyfield at this time of her life was a mere vessel of emotion untinctured by experience. The dialect was on her tongue to some extent, despite the village school, the characteristic intonation of that dialect for this district being the voicing approximately rendered by the syllable er, probably as rich an utterance as any to be found in human speech. The padded up deep red mouth to which this syllable was native had hardly as yet settled into its definite shape, and her lower lip had a way of thrusting the middle of her top one upward, when they closed together after a word. Phases of her childhood lurked in her aspect still. As she walked along today, for all her bouncing handsome womanliness, you could sometimes see her 12th year in her cheeks, or her 9th sparkling from her eyes, and even her 5th would flit over the curves of her mouth now and then. Yet few knew, and still fewer considered this. A small minority, mainly strangers, would look long at her and casually passing by, and grow momentarily fascinated by her freshness, and wonder if they would ever see her again, but to almost everybody she was a fine and picturesque country girl, and no more. Nothing was seen or heard further of Derbyfield in his triumphal chariot under the conduct of the ostleress, and the club having entered the allotted space, dancing began. As there were no men in the company, the girls danced at first with each other, but when the hour for the close of labor drew on, the masculine inhabitants of the village, together with other idlers and pedestrians, gathered round the spot, and appeared inclined to negotiate for a partner. Among these onlookers were three young men of a superior class, carrying small knapsacks strapped to their shoulders, and stout sticks in their hands. Their general likeness to each other, and their consecutive ages, would almost have suggested that they might be, what in fact they were, brothers. The eldest wore the white tie, high waistcoat, and thin-brimmed hat of the regulation curate, the second was the normal undergraduate, the appearance of the third and youngest would hardly have been sufficient to characterize him. There was an uncribbed, uncabined aspect in his eyes and attire, implying that he had hardly as yet found the entrance to his professional groove. That he was a desultory tentative student of something and everything might only have been predicted of him. These three brethren told casual acquaintance that they were spending their Whitsun holidays in a walking tour through the Vale of Blackmoor, their course being southwesterly from the town of Shaston on the northeast. They leant over the gate by the highway, and inquired as to the meaning of the dance and the white-frocked maids. The two elder of the brothers were plainly not intending to linger more than a moment, but the spectacle of a bevy of girls dancing with that male partner seemed to amuse the third, and make him in no hurry to move on. He unstrapped his knapsack, put it, with his stick, on the hedge bank, and opened the gate. "What are you going to do, Angel?" asked the eldest. "I am inclined to go and have a fling with them. Why not all of us, just for a minute or two, it will not detain us long." "No, no, nonsense," said the first. "Dancing in public with a troop of country hoydens, suppose we should be seen. Come along, or it will be dark before we get to Storecastle, and there's no place we can sleep at nearer than that, Besides, we must get through another chapter of A Counterblast to Agnosticism before we turn in. Now I have taken the trouble to bring the book. All right, I'll overtake you and Cuthbert in 5 minutes. Don't stop, I give my word that I will, Felix. The two elder reluctantly left him and walked on, taking their brother's knapsack to relieve him and following, and the youngest entered the field. This is a thousand pities, he said gallantly, to two or three of the girls nearest him, as soon as there was a pause in the dance. Where are your partners, my dears? They've not left off work yet, answered one of the boldest. They'll be here by and by. Till then, will you be one, sir? Certainly. But what's one among so many? Better than none. 'Tis melancholy work facing and footing it to one of your own sort, and no clipsing and calling at all. Now, pick and choose. SSH, don't be so foard, said a shy girl. The young man, thus invited, glanced them over, and attempted some discrimination, but, as the group were also new to him, he could not very well exercise it. He took almost the first that came to hand, which was not the speaker, as she had expected, nor did it happen to be Tess Derbyfield. Pedigree, ancestral skeletons, monumental record, the D'Urberville lineaments, did not help Tess in her life's battle as yet, even to the extent of attracting to her a dancing partner over the heads of the commonest peasantry. So much for Norman blood unaided by Victorian lucre. The name of the eclipsing girl, whatever it was, has not been handed down, but she was envied by all as the first who enjoyed the luxury of a masculine partner that evening. Yet such was the force of example that the village young men, who had not hastened to enter the gate while no intruder was in the way, now dropped in quickly, and soon the couples became leavened with rustic youth to a marked extent, till at length the plainest woman in the club was no longer compelled to foot it on the masculine side of the figure. The church clock struck, when suddenly the student said that he must leave. He had been forgetting himself, he had to join his companions. As he fell out of the dance his eyes lighted on Tess Derbyfield, whose own large orbs wore, to tell the truth, the faintest aspect of reproach that he had not chosen her. He, too, was sorry then that, owing to her backwardness, he had not observed her, and with that in his mind he left the pasture. On account of his long delay he started in a flying run down the lane westward, and had soon passed the hollow and mounted the next rise. He had not yet overtaken his brothers, but he paused to get breath, and looked back. He could see the white figures of the girls in the green enclosure whirling about as they had whirled when he was among them. They seemed to have quite forgotten him already. All of them, except, perhaps, one. This white shape stood apart by the hedge alone. From her position he knew it to be the pretty maiden with whom he had not danced. Trifling as the matter was, he yet instinctively felt that she was hurt by his oversight. He wished that he had asked her, he wished that he had inquired her name. She was so modest, so expressive, she had looked so soft in her thin white gown that he felt he had acted stupidly. However, it could not be helped, and turning, and bending himself to a rapid walk, he dismissed the subject from his mind. 3. As for Tess Derbyfield, she did not so easily dislodge the incident from her consideration. She had no spirit to dance again for a long time, though she might have had plenty of partners, but they did not speak so nicely as the strange young man had done. It was not till the rays of the sun had absorbed the young stranger's retreating figure on the hill that she shook off her temporary sadness and answered her would-be partner in the affirmative. She remained with her comrades till dusk, and participated with a certain zest in the dancing, though, being heart whole as yet, she enjoyed threading a measure purely for its own sake, little divining when she saw the soft torments, the bitter sweets, the pleasing pains, and the agreeable distresses of those girls who had been wooed and won, what she herself was capable of in that kind. The struggles and wrangles of the lads for her hand in a jig were an amusement to her, no more, and when they became fierce she rebuked them. She might have stayed even later, but the incident of her father's odd appearance and manner returned upon the girl's mind to make her anxious, and wondering what had become of him she dropped away from the dancers and bent her steps towards the end of the village at which the parental cottage lay. While yet many score yards off, other rhythmic sounds than those she had quitted became audible to her, sounds that she knew well, so well. They were a regular series of thumpings from the interior of the house, occasioned by the violent rocking of a cradle upon a stone floor, to which movement a feminine voice kept time by singing, in a vigorous galopade, the favorite ditty of the spotted cow. I saw her lie down in yonder green grove, come, love! And I'll tell you where! The cradle rocking and the song would cease simultaneously for a moment, and an exclamation at highest vocal pitch would take the place of the melody. God bless thy diamond eyes, and thy waxen cheeks, and thy cheery mouth, and thy cubit's thighs, and every bit of thy blessed body. After this invocation the rocking and the singing would recommence, and the spotted cow proceed as before. So matters stood when Tess opened the door and paused upon the mat within it, surveying the scene. The interior, in spite of the melody, struck upon the girl's senses with an unspeakable dreariness. From the holiday gaieties of the field, the white gowns, the nosegays, the willow wands, the whirling movements on the green, the flash of gentle sentiment towards the stranger, to the yellow melancholy of this one-candled spectacle, what a step! Besides the jar of contrast, there came to her a chill self-reproach that she had not returned sooner, to help her mother in these domesticities, instead of indulging herself out of doors. There stood her mother amid the group of children, as Tess had left her, hanging over the Monday washing tub, which had now, as always, lingered on to the end of the week. Out of that tub had come the day before, Tess felt it with a dreadful sting of remorse, the very white frock upon her back which she had so carelessly greened about the skirt on the damping grass, which had been wrung up and ironed by her mother's own hands. As usual, Mrs. Derbyfield was balanced on one foot beside the tub, the other being engaged in the aforesaid business of rocking her youngest child. The cradle rockers had done hard duty for so many years, under the weight of so many children, on that flagstone floor, that they were worn nearly flat, in consequence of which a huge jerk accompanied each swing of the cot, flinging the baby from side to side like a weaver's shuttle, as Mrs. Derbyfield, excited by her song, trod the rocker with all the spring that was left in her after a long day's seething in the suds. Knick-knock, knick-knock, went the cradle, the candle flame stretched itself tall, and began jigging up and down, the water dribbled from the matron's elbows, and the song galloped on to the end of the verse, Mrs. Derbyfield regarding her daughter the while. Even now, when burdened with a young family, Joan Derbyfield was a passionate lover of tune. No ditty floated into Blackmore Vale from the outer world, but Tess's mother caught up its notation in a week. There still faintly beamed from the woman's features something of the freshness, and even the prettiness, of her youth, rendering it probable that the personal charms which Tess could boast of were in main part her mother's gift, and therefore unknightly, unhistorical. "I'll rock the cradle free, mother," said the daughter gently. "Or I'll take off my best frock and help you ring up? I thought you had finished long ago." Her mother bore Tess no ill will for leaving the housework to her single-handed efforts for so long. Indeed, Joan seldom upbraided her thereon at any time, feeling but slightly the lack of Tess's assistance whilst her instinctive plan for relieving herself of her labors lay in postponing them. Tonight, however, she was even in a blither mood than usual. There was a dreaminess, a preoccupation, an exaltation, in the maternal look which the girl could not understand. "Well, I'm glad you've come," her mother said, as soon as the last note had passed out of her. "I want to go and fetch your father, but what's more than that, I want to tell 'ee what have happened. Well, be fess enough, my poppet, when THST know." Mrs. Derbyfield habitually spoke the dialect. Her daughter, who had passed the sixth standard in the national school under a London trained mistress, spoke two languages, the dialect at home, more or less, ordinary English abroad and to persons of quality, since I've been away. Tess asked. Had it anything to do with father's making such a mommet of himself in teak carriage this afternoon? Why did er? I felt inclined to sink into the ground with shame. That they're all a part of the Larry. We've been found to be the greatest gentlefolk in the whole county, reaching all back long before Oliver Grumble's time, to the days of the pagan Turks, with monuments, and vaults, and crests, and scutcheons, and the Lord knows what all. In St. Charles's days we was made Knights of the Royal Oak, our real name being D'Urberville. Don't that make your bosom plim? 'Twas on this account that your father rode home in the vlee, not because he'd been drinking, as people supposed. I'm glad of that. Will it do us any good, mother? Oh yes. 'Tis thoughted that great things may come out. No doubt a mompus of folk of our own rank will be down here in their carriages as soon as 'tis known. Your father learned it on his way home from Shaston, and he has been telling me the whole pedigree of the matter. Where is father now? Asked Tess suddenly. Her mother gave irrelevant information by way of answer. He called to see the doctor today in Shaston. It is not consumption at all, it seems. It is fat round his heart, a says. There, it is like this. Joan Derbyfield, as she spoke, curved a sodden thumb and forefinger to the shape of the letter C, and used the other forefinger as a pointer. At the present moment, he says to your father, your heart is enclosed all round there, and all round there, this space is still open, a says. As soon as it do meet, so, Mrs. Derbyfield closed her fingers into a circle complete, off you will go like a shatter, Mr. Derbyfield, a says. You mid last 10 years, you mid go off in 10 months, or 10 days. Tess looked alarmed. Her father possibly to go behind the eternal cloud so soon, notwithstanding this sudden greatness. But where is father? She asked again. Her mother put on a deprecating look. Now don't you be bursting out angry. The poor man, he felt so rafted after his uplifting by the Passon's news, that he went up to Rolliver's half an hour ago. He do want to get up his strength for his journey tomorrow with that load of beehives, which must be delivered, family or no. He'll have to start shortly after 12 tonight, as the distance is so long. Get up his strength, said Tess impetuously, the tears welling to her eyes. Oh my God. Go to a public house to get up his strength. And you as well agreed as he, mother. Her rebuke and her mood seemed to fill the whole room, and to impart a cowed look to the furniture, and candle, and children playing about, and to her mother's face. No, said the latter touchily, I be not agreed. I have been waiting for you to bide and keep house while I go fetch him. I'll go. Oh no, Tess. You see, it would be no use. Tess did not expostulate. She knew what her mother's objection meant. Mrs. Derbyfield's jacket and bonnet were already hanging slyly upon a chair by her side, in readiness for this contemplated jaunt, the reason for which the matron deplored more than its necessity. And take the complete fortune teller to the outhouse, Joan continued, rapidly wiping her hands, and donning the garments. The complete fortune teller was an old thick volume, which lay on a table at her elbow, so worn by pocketing that the margins had reached the edge of the type. Tess took it up, and her mother started. This going to hunt up her shiftless husband at the inn was one of Mrs. Derbyfield's still extant enjoyments in the muck and muddle of rearing children. To discover him at Rolliver's, to sit there for an hour or two by his side and dismiss all thought and care of the children during the interval, made her happy. A sort of halo, an occidental glow, came over life then. Troubles and other realities took on themselves a metaphysical impalpability, sinking to mere mental phenomena for serene contemplation, and no longer stood as pressing concretions which chafed body and soul. The youngsters, not immediately within sight, seemed rather bright and desirable appurtenances than otherwise. The incidents of daily life were not without humorousness and jollity in their aspect there. She felt a little as she had used to feel when she sat by her now wedded husband in the same spot during his wooing, shutting her eyes to his defects of character, and regarding him only in his ideal presentation as lover. Tess, being left alone with the younger children, went first to the outhouse with the fortune-telling book, and stuffed it into the thatch. A curious fetishistic fear of this grimy volume on the part of her mother prevented her ever allowing it to stay in the house all night, and hither it was brought back whenever it had been consulted. Between the mother, with her fast-perishing lumber of superstitions, folklore, dialect, and orally transmitted ballads, and the daughter, with her trained national teachings and standard knowledge under an infinitely revised code, there was a gap of 200 years as ordinarily understood. When they were together, the Jacobean and the Victorian ages were juxtaposed. Returning along the garden path, Tess mused on what the mother could have wished to ascertain from the book on this particular day. She guessed the recent ancestral discovery to bear upon it, but did not divine that it solely concerned herself. Dismissing this, however, she busied herself with sprinkling the linen dried during the daytime, in company with her 9-year-old brother Abraham, and her sister Eliza Louisa of 12 and a half, called Liza Lou, the youngest ones being put to bed. There was an interval of 4 years and more between Tess and the next of the family, the two who had filled the gap having died in their infancy, and this lent her a deputy maternal attitude when she was alone with her juniors. Next in juvenility to Abraham came 2 more girls, Hope and Modesty, then a boy of 3, and then the baby, who had just completed his first year. All these young souls were passengers in the Derbyfield ship, entirely dependent on the judgment of the 2 Derbyfield adults for their pleasures, their necessities, their health, even their existence. If the heads of the Derbyfield household chose to sail into difficulty, disaster, starvation, disease, degradation, death, thither were these half dozen little captives under hatches compelled to sail with him, 6 helpless creatures, who had never been asked if they wished for life on any terms, much less if they wished for it on such hard conditions as were involved in being of the shiftless house of Derbyfield. Some people would like to know whence the poet whose philosophy is in these days deemed as profound and trustworthy as his song is breezy and pure, gets his authority for speaking of nature's holy plan. It grew later, and neither father nor mother reappeared. Tess looked out of the door, and took a mental journey through Marlott. The village was shutting its eyes. Candles and lamps were being put out everywhere, she could inwardly behold the extinguisher and the extended hand. Her mother's fetching simply meant one more to fetch. Tess began to perceive that a man in indifferent health, who proposed to start on a journey before 1 in the morning, ought not to be at an inn at this late hour celebrating his ancient blood. "Abraham," she said to her little brother, "do you put on your hat, you bain't afraid? And go up to Rolliver's, and see what has gone why father and mother." The boy jumped promptly from his seat, and opened the door, and the night swallowed him up. Half an hour passed yet again, neither man, woman, nor child returned. Abraham, like his parents, seemed to have been limed and caught by the ensnaring inn. "I must go myself," she said. Lizaloo then went to bed, and Tess, locking them all in, started on her way up the dark and crooked lane or street not made for hasty progress, a street laid out before inches of land had value, and when one-handed clocks sufficiently subdivided the day. For Rolliver's Inn, the single alehouse at this end of the long and broken village, could only boast of an off-license, hence, as nobody could legally drink on the premises, the amount of overt accommodation for consumers was strictly limited to a little board about 6 inches wide and 2 yards long, fixed to the garden palings by pieces of wire, so as to form a ledge. On this board thirsty strangers deposited their cups as they stood in the road and drank, and threw the dregs on the dusty ground to the pattern of Polynesia, and wished they could have a restful seat inside. Thus the strangers. But there were also local customers who felt the same wish, and where there's a will there's a way. In a large bedroom upstairs, the window of which was thickly curtained with a great woolen shawl lately discarded by the landlady, Mrs. Rolliver, were gathered on this evening nearly a dozen persons, all seeking beatitude, all old inhabitants of the nearer end of Marlott, and frequenters of this retreat. Not only did the distance to the Pure Drop, the fully licensed tavern at the further part of the dispersed village, render its accommodation practically unavailable for dwellers at this end, but the far more serious question, the quality of the liquor, confirmed the prevalent opinion that it was better to drink with Rolliver in the corner of the housetop than with the other landlord in a wide house. A gaunt four-post bedstead which stood in the room afforded sitting space for several persons gathered round three of its sides. A couple more men had elevated themselves on a chest of drawers, another rested on the oak-carved coffer, two on the washstand, another on the stool, and thus all were, somehow, seated at their ease. The stage of mental comfort to which they had arrived at this hour was one wherein their souls expanded beyond their skins, and spread their personalities warmly through the room. In this process the chamber and its furniture grew more and more dignified and luxurious, the shawl hanging at the window took upon itself the richness of tapestry, the brass handles of the chest of drawers were as golden knockers, and the carved bedposts seemed to have some kinship with the magnificent pillars of Solomon's temple. Mrs. Derbyfield, having quickly walked hitherward after parting from Tess, opened the front door, crossed the downstairs room, which was in deep gloom, and then unfastened the stair door like one whose fingers knew the tricks of the latch as well. Her ascent of the crooked staircase was a slower process, and her face, as it rose into the light above the last stair, encountered the gaze of all the party assembled in the bedroom. "Being a few private friends I've asked in to keep up club walking at my own expense," the landlady exclaimed at the sound of footsteps, as glibly as a child repeating the catechism, while she peered over the stairs. "Oh, 'tis you, Mrs. Derbyfield. Lord, how you frighten me. I thought it might be some gaffer sent by government." Mrs. Derbyfield was welcomed with glances and nods by the remainder of the conclave, and turned to where her husband sat. He was humming absently to himself, in a low tone, "I be as good as some folks here and there. I've got a great family vault at Kingsbere sub Greenhill, and finer skeletons than any man in Wessex. I've something to tell ye that's come into my head about that, a grand project," whispered his cheerful wife. "Here, John, don't he see me?" She nudged him, while he, looking through her as through a window pane, went on with his recitative. "Hush. Don't he sing so loud, my good man," said the landlady, "in case any member of the government should be passing, and take away my license." "He's told ye what's happened to us, I suppose?" asked Mrs. Derbyfield. "Yes, in a way. Do you think there's any money hanging by it?"
"Ah, that's the secret," said Joan Derbyfield sagely. "However, 'tis well to be kin to a coach, even if you don't ride an inn." She dropped her public voice, and continued in a low tone to her husband, "I've been thinking since you brought the news that there's a great rich lady out by Trantridge, on the edge of the chase, of the name of D'Urberville." "Hey, what's that?" said Sir John. She repeated the information.
"That lady must be our relation," she said. "And my project is to send Tess to claim kin."
"There is a lady of the name, now you mention it," said Derbyfield. "Pass and Tringham didn't think of that. But she's nothing beside we, a junior branch of us, no doubt, hailing long since King Norman's day. While this question was being discussed, neither of the pair noticed, in their preoccupation, that little Abraham had crept into the room, and was awaiting an opportunity of asking them to return. "She is rich, and she'd be sure to take notice of the maid," continued Mrs. Durbeyfield, "and 'twill be a very good thing. I don't see why two branches of one family should not be on visiting terms."
"Yes, and we'll all claim kin," said Abraham brightly from under the bedstead. "And we'll all go and see her when Tess has gone to live with her, and we'll ride in her coach and wear black clothes. How do you come here, child? What nonsense be ye talking? Go away, and play on the stairs till father and mother be ready." "Well, Tess ought to go to this other member of our family. She'd be sure to win the lady, Tess would, and likely enough 'twould lead to some noble gentleman marrying her. In short, I know it. How? I tried her fate in the fortune teller, and it brought out that very thing. You should ha seen how pretty she looked today, her skin is as supple as a duchess. What says the maid herself to going? I've not asked her. She don't know there's any such lady relation yet. But it would certainly put her in the way of a grand marriage, and she won't say nay to going. Tess is queer. But she's tractable at bottom. Leave her to me." Though this conversation had been private, sufficient of its import reached the understandings of those around to suggest to them that the Durbeyfields had weightier concerns to talk of now than common folks had, and that Tess, their pretty eldest daughter, had fine prospects in store. "Tess is a fine figure of fun, as I said to myself today when I zeed her vamping round parish with the rest," observed one of the elderly boozers in an undertone. "But Joan Durbeyfield must mind that she don't get green malt in floor." It was a local phrase which had a peculiar meaning, and there was no reply. The conversation became inclusive, and presently other footsteps were heard crossing the room below. "Being a few private friends asked in tonight to keep up club walking at my own expense." The landlady had rapidly reused the formula she kept on hand for intruders before she recognized that the newcomer was Tess. Even to her mother's gaze the girl's young features looked sadly out of place amid the alcoholic vapors which floated here as no unsuitable medium for wrinkled middle age, and hardly was a reproachful flash from Tess's dark eyes needed to make her father and mother rise from their seats, hastily finish their ale, and descend the stairs behind her, Mrs. Rolliver's caution following their footsteps. "No noise, please, if ye'll be so good, my dears, or I mid lose my license, and be summonsed, and I don't know what all. Night tie." They went home together, Tess holding one arm of her father, and Mrs. Durbeyfield the other. He had, in truth, drunk very little, not a fourth of the quantity which a systematic tippler could carry to church on a Sunday afternoon without a hitch in his eastings or genuflections, but the weakness of Sir John's constitution made mountains of his petty sins in this kind. On reaching the fresh air he was sufficiently unsteady to incline the row of three at one moment as if they were marching to London, and at another as if they were marching to Bath, which produced the comical effect, frequent enough in families on nocturnal homegoings, and, like most comical effects, not quite so comic after all. The two women valiantly disguised these forced excursions and countermarches as well as they could from Durbeyfield, their cause, and from Abraham, and from themselves, and so they approached by degrees their own door, the head of the family bursting suddenly into his former refrain as he drew near, as if to fortify his soul at sight of the smallness of his present residence. "I've got a fam, illy vault at Kingsbere."
"Hush, don't be so silly, Jackie," said his wife. "Yours is not the only family that was of count in old days. Look at the Anktells, and Horseys, and the Tringhams themselves, gone to seed a'most as much as you, though you was bigger folks than they, that's true. Thank God, I was never of no family, and have nothing to be ashamed of in that way. Don't you be so sure of that. From you nater 'tis my belief you've disgraced yourselves more than any o' us, and was kings and queens outright at one time." Tess turned the subject by saying what was far more prominent in her own mind at the moment than thoughts of her ancestry, "I am afraid father won't be able to take the journey with the beehives tomorrow so early."
I shall be all right in an hour or two," said Durbeyfield. It was 11 o'clock before the family were all in bed, and 2 o'clock next morning was the latest hour for starting with the beehives if they were to be delivered to the retailers in Casterbridge before the Saturday market began, the way thither lying by bad roads over a distance of between 20 and 30 miles, and the horse and wagon being of the slowest. At 1:30 Mrs. Durbeyfield came into the large bedroom where Tess and all her little brothers and sisters slept. "The poor man can't go," she said to her eldest daughter, whose great eyes had opened the moment her mother's hand touched the door.
Tess sat up in bed, lost in a vague interspace between a dream and this information. "But somebody must go," she replied. "It is late for the hives already. Swarming will soon be over for the year, and if we put off taking them till next week's market, the call for them will be passed, and they'll be thrown on our hands." Mrs. Derbyfield looked unequal to the emergency. "Some young feller, perhaps, would go? One of them who were so much after dancing with E yesterday," she presently suggested. "Oh no, I wouldn't have it for the world," declared Tess proudly. "And letting everybody know the reason, such a thing to be ashamed of. I think I could go if Abraham could go with me to keep me company." Her mother at length agreed to this arrangement. Little Abraham was aroused from his deep sleep in a corner of the same apartment, and made to put on his clothes while still mentally in the other world. Meanwhile, Tess had hastily dressed herself, and the twain, lighting a lantern, went out to the stable. The rickety little wagon was already laden, and the girl led out the horse, Prince, only a degree less rickety than the vehicle. The poor creature looked wonderingly round at the night, at the lantern, at their two figures, as if he could not believe that at that hour, when every living thing was intended to be in shelter and at rest, he was called upon to go out and labor. They put a stock of candle ends into the lantern, hung the ladder to the offside of the load, and directed the horse onward, walking at his shoulder at first during the uphill parts of the way, in order not to overload an animal of so little vigor. To cheer themselves as well as they could, they made an artificial morning with the lantern, some bread and butter, and their own conversation, the real morning being far from come. Abraham, as he more fully awoke, for he had moved in a sort of trance so far, began to talk of the strange shapes assumed by the various dark objects against the sky, of this tree that looked like a raging tiger springing from a lair, of that which resembled the giant's head. When they had passed the little town of Storcastle, dumbly somnolent under its thick brown thatch, they reached higher ground. Still higher, on their left, the elevation called Balborough, or Bealborough, well nigh the highest in South Wessex, swelled into the sky, engirdled by its earthen trenches. From hereabout the long road was fairly level for some distance onward. They mounted in front of the wagon, and Abraham grew reflective. "Tess," he said in a preparatory tone, after a silence. "Yes, Abraham. Bain't you glad that we've become gentlefolk?" "Not particular glad. But you be glad that you am going to marry a gentleman?" "What?" said Tess, lifting her face. "That our great relation will help he to marry a gentleman." "I? Our great relation? We have no such relation. What has put that into your head?" "I heard him talking about it up at Rolliver's when I went to find father. There's a rich lady of our family out at Trantridge, and mother said that if you claimed kin with the lady, she'd put E in the way of marrying a gentleman." His sister became abruptly still, and lapsed into a pondering silence. Abraham talked on, rather for the pleasure of utterance than for audition, so that his sister's abstraction was of no account. He leant back against the hives, and with upturned face made observations on the stars, whose cold pulses were beating amid the black hollows above, in serene dissociation from these two wisps of human life. He asked how far away those twinklers were, and whether God was on the other side of them. But ever and anon his childish prattle recurred to what impressed his imagination even more deeply than the wonders of creation. If Tess were made rich by marrying a gentleman, would she have money enough to buy a spyglass so large that it would draw the stars as near to her as Nettlecombe Tout? The renewed subject, which seemed to have impregnated the whole family, filled Tess with impatience. "Never mind that now," she exclaimed. "Did you say the stars were worlds, Tess?"
"Yes."
"All like ours?"
"I don't know, but I think so. They sometimes seem to be like the apples on our stubborn tree. Most of them splendid and sound, a few blighted. Which do we live on, a splendid one or a blighted one?"
"A blighted one. 'Tis very unlucky that we didn't pitch on a sound one, when there were so many more of them."
"Yes.
Is it like that really, Tess?" said Abraham, turning to her much impressed, on reconsideration of this rare information. "How would it have been if we had pitched on a sound one?
Well, father wouldn't have coughed and creeped about as he does, and wouldn't have got too tipsy to go on this journey, and mother wouldn't have been always washing, and never getting finished.
And you would have been a rich lady ready-made, and not have had to be made rich by marrying a gentleman?"
"Oh, abye, don't talk of that anymore." Left to his reflections, Abraham soon grew drowsy. Tess was not skillful in the management of a horse, but she thought that she could take upon herself the entire conduct of the load for the present and allow Abraham to go to sleep if he wished to do so. She made him a sort of nest in front of the hives, in such a manner that he could not fall, and, taking the reins into her own hands, jogged on as before.
Prince required but slight attention, lacking energy for superfluous movements of any sort. With no longer a companion to distract her, Tess fell more deeply into reverie than ever, her back leaning against the hives. The mute procession past her shoulders of trees and hedges became attached to fantastic scenes outside reality, and the occasional heave of the wind became the sigh of some immense sad soul, conterminous with the universe and space, and with history and time. Then, examining the mesh of events in her own life, she seemed to see the vanity of her father's pride, the gentlemanly suitor awaiting herself in her mother's fancy, to see him as a grimacing personage, laughing at her poverty and her shrouded knightly ancestry. Everything grew more and more extravagant, and she no longer knew how time passed. A sudden jerk shook her in her seat, and Tess awoke from the sleep into which she, too, had fallen. They were a long way further on than when she had lost consciousness, and the wagon had stopped. A hollow groan, unlike anything she had ever heard in her life, came from the front, followed by a shout of "Hoy there!" The lantern hanging at her wagon had gone out, but another was shining in her face, much brighter than her own had been. Something terrible had happened. The harness was entangled with an object which blocked the way. In consternation, Tess jumped down, and discovered the dreadful truth. The groan had proceeded from her father's poor horse Prince. The morning mail cart, with its two noiseless wheels, speeding along these lanes like an arrow, as it always did, had driven into her slow and unlighted equipage. The pointed shaft of the cart had entered the breast of the unhappy prince like a sword, and from the wound his life's blood was spouting in a stream, and falling with a hiss into the road. In her despair, Tess sprang forward and put her hand upon the hole, with the only result that she became splashed from face to skirt with the crimson drops. Then she stood helplessly looking on. Prince also stood firm and motionless as long as he could, till he suddenly sank down in a heap. By this time the mail cart man had joined her, and began dragging and unharnessing the hot form of Prince. But he was already dead, and, seeing that nothing more could be done immediately, the mail cart man returned to his own animal, which was uninjured. "You was on the wrong side," he said. "I am bound to go on with the mail bags, so that the best thing for you to do is bide here with your load. I'll send somebody to help you as soon as I can. It is getting daylight, and you have nothing to fear." He mounted and sped on his way, while Tess stood and waited. The atmosphere turned pale, the birds shook themselves in the hedges, arose, and twittered, the lane showed all its white features, and Tess showed hers, still whiter. The huge pool of blood in front of her was already assuming the iridescence of coagulation, and when the sun rose 100 prismatic hues were reflected from it. Prince lay alongside, still and stark, his eyes half open, the hole in his chest looking scarcely large enough to have let out all that had animated him. "'Tis all my doing, all mine," the girl cried, gazing at the spectacle. "No excuse for me, none. What will mother and father live on now? Abye, abye." She shook the child, who had slept soundly through the whole disaster. "We can't go on with our load, Prince is killed." When Abraham realized all, the furrows of 50 years were extemporized on his young face. "Why, I danced and laughed only yesterday," she went on to herself. "To think that I was such a fool. 'Tis because we be on a blighted star, and not a sound one, isn't it, Tess?" murmured Abraham through his tears. In silence they waited through an interval which seemed endless. At length the sound, and an approaching object, proved to them that the driver of the mail car had been as good as his word. A farmer's man from near Storecastle came up, leading a strong cob. He was harnessed to the wagon of Beehives in the place of Prince, and the load taken on towards Casterbridge. The evening of the same day saw the empty wagon reach again the spot of the accident. Prince had lain there in the ditch since the morning, but the place of the blood pool was still visible in the middle of the road, though scratched and scraped over by passing vehicles. All that was left of Prince was now hoisted into the wagon he had formerly hauled, and with his hoofs in the air, and his shoes shining in the setting sunlight, he retraced the 8 or 9 miles to Marlott. Tess had gone back earlier. How to break the news was more than she could think. It was a relief to her tongue to find from the faces of her parents that they already knew of their loss, though this did not lessen the self-reproach which she continued to heap upon herself for her negligence. But the very shiftlessness of the household rendered the misfortune a less terrifying one to them than it would have been to a thriving family, though in the present case it meant ruin, and in the other it would only have meant inconvenience. In the Derbyfield countenances there was nothing of the red wrap that would have burned upon the girl from parents more ambitious for her welfare. Nobody blamed Tess as she blamed herself. When it was discovered that the knacker and tanner would give only a very few shillings for Prince's carcass because of his decrepitude, Derbyfield rose to the occasion. No, said he stoically, I won't sell his old body. When we d'Urbervilles was knights in the land, we didn't sell our chargers for cat's meat. Let him keep their shillings. He've served me well in his lifetime, and I won't part from him now. He worked harder the next day in digging a grave for Prince in the garden than he had worked for months to grow a crop for his family. When the hole was ready, Derbyfield and his wife tied a rope round the horse and dragged him up the path towards it, the children following in funeral train. Abraham and Liza Lou sobbed, hope and modesty discharged their griefs in loud blares which echoed from the walls, and when Prince was tumbled and they gathered round the grave. The breadwinner had been taken away from them, what would they do? Is he gone to heaven? Asked Abraham, between the sobs. Then Derbyfield began to shovel in the earth, and the children cried anew. All except Tess. Her face was dry and pale, as though she regarded herself in the light of a murderess. V. The haggling business, which had mainly depended on the horse, became disorganized forthwith. Distress, if not penury, loomed in the distance. Derbyfield was what was locally called a slack, twisted fellow. He had good strength to work at times, but the times could not be relied on to coincide with the hours of requirement, and, having been unaccustomed to the regular toil of the day laborer, he was not particularly persistent when they did so coincide. Tess, meanwhile, as the one who had dragged her parents into this quagmire, was silently wondering what she could do to help them out of it, and then her mother broached her scheme. We must take the ups why the downs, Tess, said she, and never could your high blood have been found out at a more called-for moment. You must try your friends. Do ye know that there is a very rich Mrs. D'Urberville living on the outskirts of the chase, who must be our relation? You must go to her and claim kin, and ask for some help in our trouble. I shouldn't care to do that, says Tess. If there is such a lady, 'twould be enough for us if she were friendly, not to expect her to give us help. You could win her round to do anything, my dear. Besides, perhaps there's more in it than you know of. I've heard what I've heard, good now. The oppressive sense of the harm she had done led Tess to be more deferential than she might otherwise have been to the maternal wish, but she could not understand why her mother should find such satisfaction in contemplating an enterprise of, to her, such doubtful profit. Her mother might have made inquiries, and have discovered that this Mrs. D'Urberville was a lady of unequaled virtues and charity. But Tess's pride made the part of poor relation one of particular distaste to her. I'd rather try to get work, she murmured. Derbyfield, you can settle it, said his wife, turning to where he sat in the background. If you say she ought to go, she will go. I don't like my children going and making themselves beholden to strange kin, murmured he. I'm the head of the noblest branch of the family, and I ought to live up to it. His reasons for staying away were worse to Tess than her own objections to going. Well, as I killed the horse, mother, she said mournfully, I suppose I ought to do something. I don't mind going and seeing her, but you must leave it to me about asking for help. And don't go thinking about her making a match for me, it is silly. Very well said, Tess, observed her father sententiously. Who said I had such a thought? Asked Joan. I fancy it is in your mind, mother. But I'll go. Rising early next day she walked to the hill town called Shaston, and there took advantage of a van which twice in the week ran from Shaston eastward to Chaseborough, passing near Trantridge, the parish in which the vague and mysterious Mrs. D'Urberville had her residence. Tess Derbyfield's route on this memorable morning lay amid the northeastern undulations of the vale in which she had been born, and in which her life had unfolded. The Vale of Blackmoor was to her the world, and its inhabitants the races thereof. From the gates and stiles of Marlott she had looked down its length in the wondering days of infancy, and what had been mystery to her then was not much less than mystery to her now. She had seen daily from her chamber window towers, villages, faint white mansions, above all, the town of Shaston standing majestically on its height, its windows shining like lamps in the evening sun. She had hardly ever visited the place, only a small tract even of the vale and its environs being known to her by close inspection. Much less had she been far outside the valley. Every contour of the surrounding hills was as personal to her as that of her relatives' faces, but for what lay beyond, her judgment was dependent on the teaching of the village school, where she had held a leading place at the time of her leaving, a year or two before this date. In those early days she had been much loved by others of her own sex and age, and had used to be seen about the village as one of three, all nearly of the same year, walking home from school side by side, Tess the middle one, in a pink print pinafore, of a finely reticulated pattern, worn over a stuff frock that had lost its original color for a nondescript tertiary, marching on upon long stocky legs, in tight stockings which had little ladder-like holes at the knees, torn by kneeling in the roads and banks in search of vegetable and mineral treasures, her then earth-colored hair hanging like pothooks, the arms of the two outside girls resting round the waist of Tess, her arms on the shoulders of the two supporters. As Tess grew older, and began to see how matters stood, she felt quite a malfusion towards her mother for thoughtlessly giving her so many little sisters and brothers, when it was such a trouble to nurse and provide for them. Her mother's intelligence was that of a happy child, Joan Derbyfield was simply an additional one, and that not the eldest, to her own long family of waiters on Providence. However, Tess became humanely beneficent towards the small ones, and to help them as much as possible she used, as soon as she left school, to lend a hand at haymaking or harvesting on neighboring farms, or, by preference, at milking or butter-making processes, which she had learnt when her father had owned cows, and being deft-fingered it was a kind of work in which she excelled. Every day seemed to throw upon her young shoulders more of the family burdens, and that Tess should be the representative of the Derbyfields at the D'Urberville mansion came as a thing of course. In this instance it must be admitted that the Derbyfields were putting their fairest side outward. She alighted from the van at Trantridge Cross, and ascended on foot a hill in the direction of the district known as the Chase, on the borders of which, as she had been informed, Mrs. D'Urberville's seat, the Slopes, would be found. It was not a manorial home in the ordinary sense, with fields, and pastures, and a grumbling farmer, out of whom the owner had to squeeze an income for himself and his family by hook or by crook. It was more, far more, a country house built for enjoyment pure and simple, with not an acre of troublesome land attached to it beyond what was required for residential purposes, and for a little fancy farm kept in hand by the owner, and tended by a bailiff. The crimson brick lodge came first in sight, up to its eaves in dense evergreens. Tess thought this was the mansion itself till, passing through the side wicket with some trepidation, and onward to a point at which the drive took a turn, the house proper stood in full view. It was of recent erection, indeed almost new, and of the same rich red color that formed such a contrast with the evergreens of the lodge. Far behind the corner of the house, which rose like a geranium bloom against the subdued colors around, stretched the soft azure landscape of the Chase, a truly venerable tract of forest land, one of the few remaining woodlands in England of undoubted primeval date, wherein druidical mistletoe was still found on aged oaks, and where enormous yew trees, not planted by the hand of man grew as they had grown when they were pollarded for bows. All this sylvan antiquity, however, though visible from the slopes, was outside the immediate boundaries of the estate. Everything on this snug property was bright, thriving, and well kept. Acres of glass houses stretched down the inclines to the copses at their feet. Everything looked like money, like the last coin issued from the mint. The stables, partly screened by Austrian pines and evergreen oaks, and fitted with every late appliance, were as dignified as chapels of ease. On the extensive lawn stood an ornamental tent, its door being towards her. Simple Tess Derbyfield stood at gaze, in a half-alarmed attitude, on the edge of the gravel sweep. Her feet had brought her onward to this point before she had quite realized where she was, and now all was contrary to her expectation. "I thought we were an old family, but this is all new," she said, in her artlessness. She wished that she had not fallen in so readily with her mother's plans for claiming kin, and had endeavored to gain assistance nearer home. The D'Urbervilles, or Stoke D'Urbervilles, as they at first called themselves, who owned all this, were a somewhat unusual family to find in such an old-fashioned part of the country. Parson Tringham had spoken truly when he said that our shambling John Derbyfield was the only really lineal representative of the old D'Urberville family existing in the county, or near it. He might have added, what he knew very well, that the Stoke D'Urbervilles were no more D'Urbervilles of the true tree than he was himself. Yet it must be admitted that this family formed a very good stock whereon to regraft a name which sadly wanted such renovation. When old Mr. Simon Stoke, latterly deceased, had made his fortune as an honest merchant, some said money lender, in the north, he decided to settle as a county man in the south of England, out of hail of his business district, and in doing this he felt the necessity of recommencing with a name that would not too readily identify him with the smart tradesman of the past, and that would be less commonplace than the original bald, stark words. Conning for an hour in the British Museum the pages of works devoted to extinct, half-extinct, obscured, and ruined families appertaining to the quarter of England in which he proposed to settle, he considered that D'Urberville looked and sounded as well as any of them, and D'Urberville accordingly was annexed to his own name for himself and his heirs eternally. Yet he was not an extravagant-minded man in this, and in constructing his family tree on the new basis was duly reasonable in framing his intermarriages and aristocratic links, never inserting a single title above a rank of strict moderation. Of this work of imagination, poor Tess and her parents were naturally in ignorance, much to their discomfiture. Indeed, the very possibility of such annexations was unknown to them, who supposed that, though to be well-favored might be the gift of fortune, a family name came by nature. Tess still stood hesitating like a bather about to make his plunge, hardly knowing whether to retreat or to persevere, when a figure came forth from the dark triangular door of the tent. It was that of a tall young man, smoking. He had an almost swarthy complexion, with full lips, badly molded, though red and smooth, above which was a well-groomed black mustache with curled points, though his age could not be more than 3 or 4 and 20. Despite the touches of barbarism in his contours, there was a singular force in the gentleman's face, and in his bold rolling eye. "Well, my beauty, what can I do for you?" said he, coming forward. And perceiving that she stood quite confounded, "Never mind me. I am Mr. D'Urberville. Have you come to see me or my mother?" This embodiment of a D'Urberville and a namesake differed even more from what Tess had expected than the house and grounds had differed. She had dreamed of an aged and dignified face, the sublimation of all the D'Urberville lineaments, furrowed with incarnate memories representing in hieroglyphic the centuries of her family's and England's history. But she screwed herself up to the work in hand, since she could not get out of it, and answered, "I came to see your mother, sir." "I am afraid you cannot see her, she is an invalid," replied the present representative of the spurious house, for this was Mr. Alec, the only son of the lately deceased gentleman. "Cannot I answer your purpose? What is the business you wish to see her about?"
"It isn't business, it is, I can hardly say what."
"Pleasure?
Oh no.
Why, sir, if I tell you, it will seem..." Tessa's sense of a certain ludicrousness in her errand was now so strong that, notwithstanding her awe of him, and her general discomfort at being here, her rosy lips curved towards a smile, much to the attraction of the swarthy Alexander.
"It is so very foolish," she stammered, "I fear I can't tell you."
"Never mind, I like foolish things."
"Try again, my dear," said he kindly.
"Mother asked me to come," Tess continued, "and, indeed, I was in the mind to do so myself likewise. But I did not think it would be like this. I came, sir, to tell you that we are of the same family as you."
"Ho! Poor relations?"
"Yes."
"Stokes?"
"No, D'Urbervilles. I mean D'Urbervilles. Our names are worn away to Derbyfield, but we have several proofs that we are D'Urbervilles. Antiquarians hold we are, and we have an old seal, marked with a ramping lion on a shield, and a castle over him. And we have a very old silver spoon, round in the bowl like a little ladle, and marked with the same castle. But it is so worn that Mother uses it to stir the pea soup."
"A castle argent is certainly my crest," said he blandly.
"And my arms a lion rampant. And so Mother said we ought to make ourselves beknown to you, as we've lost our horse by a bad accident, and are the oldest branch of the family."
"Very kind of your mother, I'm sure. And I, for one, don't regret her step." Alec looked at Tess as he spoke, in a way that made her blush a little.
"And so, my pretty girl, you've come on a friendly visit to us, as relations?"
"I suppose I have," faltered Tess, looking uncomfortable again.
"Well, there's no harm in it. Where do you live? What are you?" She gave him brief particulars, and responding to further inquiries told him that she was intending to go back by the same carrier who had brought her. "It is a long while before he returns past Trantridge Cross. Supposing we walk round the grounds to pass the time, my pretty coz?" Tess wished to abridge her visit as much as possible, but the young man was pressing, and she consented to accompany him. He conducted her about the lawns, and flower beds, and conservatories, and thence to the fruit garden and greenhouses, where he asked her if she liked strawberries.
"Yes," said Tess, "when they come. They are already here."
D'Urberville began gathering specimens of the fruit for her, handing them back to her as he stooped, and, presently, selecting a specially fine product of the British Queen variety, he stood up and held it by the stem to her mouth.
"No, no,"
she said quickly, putting her fingers between his hand and her lips. "I would rather take it in my own hand."
"Nonsense,"
he insisted, and in a slight distress she parted her lips and took it in. They had spent some time wandering desultorily thus, Tess eating in a half-pleased, half-reluctant state whatever D'Urberville offered her. When she could consume no more of the strawberries he filled her little basket with him, and then the two passed round to the roseries, whence he gathered blossoms and gave her to put in her bosom. She obeyed like one in a dream, and when she could affix no more he himself tucked a butt or two into her hat, and heaped her basket with others in the prodigality of his bounty. At last, looking at his watch, he said, "Now, by the time you have had something to eat, it will be time for you to leave, if you want to catch the carrier to Shaston. Come here, and I'll see what grub I can find." Stoke d'Urberville took her back to the lawn and into the tent, where he left her, soon reappearing with a basket of light luncheon, which he put before her himself. It was evidently the gentleman's wish not to be disturbed in this pleasant tête-à-tête by the servantry. "Do you mind my smoking?" he asked. "Oh, not at all, sir." He watched her pretty and unconscious munching through the skeins of smoke that pervaded the tent, and Tess Durbeyfield did not divine, as she innocently looked down at the roses in her bosom, that there behind the blue narcotic haze was potentially the tragic mischief of her drama, one who stood fair to be the blood-red ray in the spectrum of her young life. She had an attribute which amounted to a disadvantage just now, and it was this that caused Alec D'Urberville's eyes to rivet themselves upon her. It was a luxuriance of aspect, a fullness of growth, which made her appear more of a woman than she really was. She had inherited the feature from her mother without the quality it denoted. It had troubled her mind occasionally, till her companions had said that it was a fault which time would cure. She soon had finished her lunch. "Now I am going home, sir," she said, rising. "And what do they call you?" he asked, as he accompanied her along the drive till they were out of sight of the house. "Tess Durbeyfield, down at Marlott." "And you say your people have lost their horse?"
"I killed him," she answered, her eyes filling with tears as she gave particulars of Prince's death.
"And I don't know what to do for father on account of it. I must think if I cannot do something. My mother must find a berth for you. But, Tess, no nonsense about D'Urberville, Durbeyfield only, you know, quite another name."
"I wish for no better, sir," said she with something of dignity. For a moment, only for a moment, when they were in the turning of the drive, between the tall rhododendrons and conifers, before the lodge became visible, he inclined his face towards her as if, but, number he thought better of it, and let her go. Thus the thing began. Had she perceived this meeting's import she might have asked why she was doomed to be seen and coveted that day by the wrong man, and not by some other man, the right and desired one in all respects, as nearly as humanity can supply the right and desired, yet to him who amongst her acquaintance might have approximated to this kind, she was but a transient impression, half forgotten. In the ill-judged execution of the well-judged plan of things the call seldom produces the comer, the man to love rarely coincides with the hour for loving. Nature does not often say see to her poor creature at a time when seeing can lead to happy doing, or reply here to a body's cry of where, till the hide-and-seek has become an irksome, outworn game. We may wonder whether at the acme and summit of the human progress these anachronisms will be corrected by a finer intuition, a closer interaction of the social machinery than that which now jolts us round and along, but such completeness is not to be prophesied, or even conceived as possible. Enough that in the present case, as in millions, it was not the two halves of a perfect whole that confronted each other at the perfect moment. A missing counterpart wandered independently about the earth waiting in crass obtuseness till the late time came. Out of which maladroit delay sprang anxieties, disappointments, shocks, catastrophes, and passing strange destinies. When D'Urberville got back to the tent he sat down astride on a chair, reflecting, with a pleased gleam in his face. Then he broke into a loud laugh. "Well, I'm damned. What a funny thing. Ha ha ha. And what a crummy girl." Vitesse went down the hill to Trantridge Cross, and inattentively waited to take her seat in the van returning from Chaseborough to Shaston. She did not know what the other occupants said to her as she entered, though she answered them, and when they had started anew she rode along with an inward and not an outward eye. One among her fellow travellers addressed her more pointedly than any had spoken before, "Why, you be quite a posy. And such roses in early June." Then she became aware of the spectacle she presented to their surprised vision, roses at her breasts, roses in her hat, roses and strawberries in her basket to the brim. She blushed, and said confusedly that the flowers had been given to her. When the passengers were not looking she stealthily removed the more prominent blooms from her hat and placed them in the basket, where she covered them with her handkerchief. Then she fell to reflecting again, and in looking downwards a thorn of the rose remaining in her breast accidentally pricked her chin. Like all the cottagers in Blackmoor Vale, Tess was steeped in fancies and prefigurative superstitions. She thought this an ill omen, the first she had noticed that day. The van travelled only so far as Shaston, and there were several miles of pedestrian descent from that mountain town into the vale to Marlott.
Her mother had advised her to stay here for the night, at the house of a cottage woman they knew, if she should feel too tired to come on, and this Tess did, not descending to her home till the following afternoon. When she entered the house, she perceived in a moment from her mother's triumphant manner that something had occurred in the interim.
"Oh yes, I know all about it. I told ye it would be all right, and now 'tis proved.
Since I've been away?"
"What has?"
said Tess rather wearily. Her mother surveyed the girl up and down with arch approval, and went on banteringly, "So you've brought him round.
How do you know, mother?"
"I've had a letter." Tess then remembered that there would have been time for this. "They say, Mrs. D'Urberville says, that she wants you to look after a little fowl farm, which is her hobby. But this is only her artful way of getting ye there without raising your hopes. She's going to own ye as kin, that's the meaning o't.
But I didn't see her."
"You did somebody, I suppose?"
"I saw her son."
"And did he own ye?"
"Well, he called me Coz.
And I knew it."
"Jackie, he called her Coz," cried Joan to her husband.
"Well, he spoke to his mother, of course, and she do want ye there. But I don't know that I am apt at tending fowls," said the dubious Tess.
"Then I don't know who is apt.
You've been born in the business, and brought up in it. They that be born in a business always know more about it than any prentice. Besides, that's only just a show of something for you to do, that you mightn't feel beholden."
"I don't altogether think I ought to go," said Tess thoughtfully.
"Who wrote the letter?
Will you let me look at it?"
"Mrs. D'Urberville wrote it. Here it is." The letter was in the third person, and briefly informed Mrs. Derbyfield that her daughter's services would be useful to that lady in the management of her poultry farm, that a comfortable room would be provided for her if she could come, and that the wages would be on a liberal scale if they liked her.
"Oh, that's all," said Tess. "You couldn't expect her to throw her arms round ye, and to kiss and to cull ye all at once."
Tess looked out of the window.
"I would rather stay here with father and you," she said.
"But why?"
"I'd rather not tell you why, mother. Indeed, I don't quite know why."
A week afterwards she came in one evening from an unavailing search for some light occupation in the immediate neighborhood. Her idea had been to get together sufficient money during the summer to purchase another horse. Hardly had she crossed the threshold before one of the children danced across the room, saying, "The gentleman's been here." Her mother hastened to explain, smiles breaking from every inch of her person. Mrs. D'Urberville's son had called on horseback, having been riding by chance in the direction of Marlott. He had wished to know, finally, in the name of his mother, if Tess could really come to manage the old lady's fowl farm or not, the lad who had hitherto superintended the birds having proved untrustworthy. "Mr. D'Urberville says you must be a good girl if you are at all as you appear. He knows you must be worth your weight in gold. He is very much interested in ye, truth to tell." Tess seemed for the moment really pleased to hear that she had won such high opinion from a stranger when, in her own esteem, she had sunk so low.
"It is very good of him to think that," she murmured, "and if I was quite sure how it would be living there, I would go anywhen. He is a mighty handsome man."
"I don't think so," said Tess coldly.
"Well, there's your chance, whether or no, and I'm sure he wears a beautiful diamond ring."
"Yes," said little Abraham, brightly, from the window bench, "and I seed it. And it did twinkle when he put his hand up to his Miss Tarsher's."
"Mother, why did our grand relation keep on putting his hand up to his Miss Tarsher's?
Hark at that child," cried Mrs. Derbyfield, with parenthetic admiration.
"Perhaps to show his diamond ring," murmured Sir John, dreamily, from his chair.
"I'll think it over," said Tess, leaving the room.
"Well, she's made a conquest to the younger branch of us, straight off," continued the matron to her husband, "and she's a fool if she don't follow it up."
"I don't quite like my children going away from home," said the haggler. "As the head of the family, the rest ought to come to me.
But do let her go, Jackie," coaxed his poor witless wife.
"He's struck by her, you can see that. He called her Coz. He'll marry her, most likely, and make a lady of her, and then she'll be what her forefathers was."
John Derbyfield had more conceit than energy or health, and this supposition was pleasant to him.
"Well, perhaps that's what young Mr. D'Urberville means," he admitted, and sure enough he did have serious thoughts about improving his blood by linking onto the old line.
Tess, the little rogue. And have she really paid him a visit to such an end as this?
Meanwhile Tess was walking thoughtfully among the gooseberry bushes in the garden, and over Prince's grave. When she came in her mother pursued her advantage.
"Well, what be you going to do?"
she asked.
"I wish I had seen Mrs. D'Urberville," said Tess.
"I think you might as well settle it. Then you'll see her soon enough."
Her father coughed in his chair.
"I don't know what to say.
answered the girl restlessly. It is for you to decide. I killed the old horse, and I suppose I ought to do something to get ye a new one. But, I don't quite like Mr. D'Urberville being there. The children, who had made use of this idea of Tess being taken up by their wealthy kinsfolk, which they imagined the other family to be, as a species of dolor refuge after the death of the horse, began to cry at Tess's reluctance, and teased and reproached her for hesitating. Tess won't go and be made a la die of. No, she says she won't. They wailed, with square mouths. And we shan't have a nice new horse, and lots of golden money to buy fairlings. And Tess won't look pretty in her best clothes no more. Her mother chimed into the same tune, a certain way she had of making her labors in the house seem heavier than they were by prolonging them indefinitely, also weighed in the argument. Her father alone preserved an attitude of neutrality. I will go, said Tess at last. Her mother could not repress her consciousness of the nuptial vision conjured up by the girl's consent. That's right. For such a pretty maid as tis, this is a fine chance. Tess smiled crossly. I hope it is a chance for earning money. It is no other kind of chance. You had better say nothing of that silly sort about Parrish. Mrs. Durbeyfield did not promise. She was not quite sure that she did not feel proud enough, after the visitor's remarks, to say a good deal. Thus it was arranged, and the young girl wrote, agreeing to be ready to set out on any day on which she might be required. She was duly informed that Mrs. D'Urberville was glad of her decision, and that a spring cart should be sent to meet her and her luggage at the top of the vale on the day after the morrow, when she must hold herself prepared to start. Mrs. D'Urberville's handwriting seemed rather masculine. A cart? Murmured Joan Durbeyfield doubtingly. It might have been a carriage for her own kin. Having at last taken her course, Tess was less restless and abstracted, going about her business with some self-assurance in the thought of acquiring another horse for her father by an occupation which would not be onerous. She had hoped to be a teacher at the school, but the fates seemed to decide otherwise. Being mentally older than her mother, she did not regard Mrs. Durbeyfield's matrimonial hopes for her in a serious aspect for a moment. The light-minded woman had been discovering good matches for her daughter almost from the year of her birth. 7 on the morning appointed for her departure, Tess was awake before dawn, at the marginal minute of the dark when the grove is still mute, save for one prophetic bird who sings with a clear-voiced conviction that he at least knows the correct time of day, the rest preserving silence as if equally convinced that he is mistaken. She remained upstairs packing till breakfast time, and then came down in her ordinary weekday clothes, her Sunday apparel being carefully folded in her box. Her mother expostulated. You will never set out to see your folks without dressing up more the dawn than that? But I am going to work, said Tess. Well, yes, said Mrs. Durbeyfield, and in a private tone, at first there may be a little pretense out, but I think it will be wiser of you to put your best side outward, she added. Very well, I suppose you know best, replied Tess with calm abandonment. And to please her parent the girl put herself quite in Joan's hands, saying serenely, do what you like with me, Mother. Mrs. Durbeyfield was only too delighted at this tractability. First she fetched a great basin, and washed Tess's hair with such thoroughness that when dried and brushed it looked twice as much as at other times. She tied it with a broader pink ribbon than usual. Then she put upon her the white frock that Tess had worn at the club walking, the airy fullness of which, supplementing her enlarged coiffure, imparted to her developing figure an amplitude which belied her age, and might cause her to be estimated as a woman when she was not much more than a child. I declare there's a hole in my stocking heel, said Tess. Never mind holes in your stockings, they don't speak. When I was a maid, so long as I had a pretty bonnet the devil might ha found me in heels. Her mother's pride in the girl's appearance led her to step back, like a painter from his easel, and survey her work as a whole. You must see yourself, she cried. It is much better than you was t'other day. As the looking-glass was only large enough to reflect a very small portion of Tess's person at one time, Mrs. Durbeyfield hung a black cloak outside the casement, and so made a large reflector of the panes, as it is the wont of bedecking cottagers to do. After this she went downstairs to her husband, who was sitting in the lower room. I'll tell you what 'tis, Durbeyfield, said she exultingly, he'll never have the heart not to love her. But whatever you do, don't say too much to Tess of his fancy for her, and this chance she has got. She is such an odd maid that it mid set her against him, or against going there, even now. If all goes well, I shall certainly be for making some return to pass in at Stagfoot Lane for telling us, dear, good man. However, as the moment for the girls setting out drew nigh, when the first excitement of the dressing had passed off, a slight misgiving found place in Joan Durbeyfield's mind.
It prompted the matron to say that she would walk a little way, as far as to the point where the acclivity from the valley began its first steep ascent to the outer world. At the top, Tess was going to be met with a spring cart sent by the Stoke d'Urbervilles, and her box had already been wheeled ahead towards this summit by a lad with trucks, to be in readiness. Seeing their mother put on her bonnet, the younger children clamored to go with her. "I do want to walk a little ways, why sissy, now she's going to marry our gentleman cousin, and wear fine clothes. Now," said Tess, flushing and turning quickly, "I'll hear no more of that. Mother, how could you ever put such stuff into their heads? Going to work, my dears, for our rich relation, and help get enough money for a new horse," said Mrs. Derbyfield pacifically. "Goodbye, father," said Tess, with a lumpy throat. "Goodbye, my maid," said Sir John, raising his head from his breast as he suspended his nap, induced by slight excess this morning in honor of the occasion. "Well, I hope my young friend will like such a comely sample of his own blood. And tell him, Tess, that being sunk, quite, from our former grandeur, I'll sell him the title, yes, sell it, and at no unreasonable figure. Not for less than £1,000. Cried Lady Derbyfield. "Tell him, I'll take £1,000. Well, I'll take less, when I come to think o't. He'll adorn it better than a poor lambkin feller like myself can. Tell him he shall hay it for 100. But I won't stand upon trifles, tell him he shall hay it for 50, for £20. Yes, £20, that's the lowest. Dammy, family honor is family honor, and I won't take a penny less." Tess's eyes were too full and her voice too choked to utter the sentiments that were in her. She turned quickly, and went out. So the girls and their mother all walked together, a child on each side of Tess, holding her hand and looking at her meditatively from time to time, as at one who was about to do great things, her mother just behind with the smallest, the group forming a picture of honest beauty flanked by innocence, and backed by simple soul vanity. They followed the way till they reached the beginning of the ascent, on the crest of which the vehicle from Trantridge was to receive her, this limit having been fixed to save the horse the labor of the last slope. Far away behind the first hills the cliff-like dwellings of Shaston broke the line of the ridge. Nobody was visible in the elevated road which skirted the ascent save the lad whom they had sent on before them, sitting on the handle of the barrow that contained all Tess's worldly possessions. "Bide here a bit, and the cart will soon come, no doubt," said Mrs. Derbyfield. "Yes, I see it yonder." It had come, appearing suddenly from behind the forehead of the nearest upland, and stopping beside the boy with the barrow. Her mother and the children thereupon decided to go no farther, and bidding them a hasty goodbye, Tess bent her steps up the hill. They saw her white shape draw near to the spring cart, on which her box was already placed. But before she had quite reached it, another vehicle shot out from a clump of trees on the summit, came round the bend of the road there, past the luggage cart, and halted beside Tess, who looked up as if in great surprise. Her mother perceived, for the first time, that the second vehicle was not a humble conveyance like the first, but a spick-and-span gig or dogcart, highly varnished and equipped. The driver was a young man of 3 or 4 and 20, with a cigar between his teeth, wearing a dandy cap, drab jacket, breeches of the same hue, white neckcloth, stick-up collar, and brown driving gloves. In short, he was a handsome, horsey young buck who had visited Joan a week or two before to get her answer about Tess. Mrs. Derbyfield clapped her hands like a child. Then she looked down, then stared again. Could she be deceived as to the meaning of this? "Is that the gentleman kinsman who'll make Sissy a lady?" asked the youngest child. Meanwhile the muslin form of Tess could be seen standing still, undecided, beside this turnout, whose owner was talking to her. Her seeming indecision was, in fact, more than indecision, it was misgiving. She would have preferred the humble cart. The young man dismounted, and appeared to urge her to ascend. She turned her face down the hill to her relatives, and regarded the little group. Something seemed to quicken her to a determination, possibly the thought that she had killed Prince. She suddenly stepped up, he mounted beside her, and immediately whipped on the horse. In a moment they had passed the slow cart with the box, and disappeared behind the shoulder of the hill. Directly Tess was out of sight, and the interest of the matter as a drama was at an end, the little one's eyes filled with tears. The youngest child said, "I wish poor Tess wasn't gone away to be a lady." And, lowering the corners of his lips, burst out crying. The new point of view was infectious, and the next child did likewise, and then the next, till the whole three of them wailed loud. There were tears also in Joan Derbyfield's eyes as she turned to go home. But by the time she had got back to the village she was passively trusting to the favor of accident. However, in bed that night she sighed,
and her husband asked her what was the matter.
"Oh, I don't know exactly," she said. "I was thinking that perhaps it would have been better if Tess had not gone.
Oughtn't ye to have thought of that before?"
"Well, 'tis a chance for the maid. Still, if 'twere the doing again, I wouldn't let her go till I had found out whether the gentleman is really a good-hearted young man in choice over her as his kinswoman."
"Yes, you ought, perhaps, to ha' done that," snored Sir John. Joan Durbeyfield always managed to find consolation somewhere. "Well, as one of the genuine stock, she ought to make her way with N, if she plays her trump card aright. And if he don't marry her afore he will after. For that he's all afire why love for her any I can see."
"What's her trump card?"
"Her Durbeyfield blood, you mean?"
"No, stupid, her face, as 'twas mine."
Eight having mounted beside her, Alec Durbeyfield drove rapidly along the crest of the first hill, chatting compliments to Tess as they went, the cart with her box being left far behind. Rising still, an immense landscape stretched around them on every side: behind, the green valley of her birth; before, a grey country of which she knew nothing except from her first brief visit to Trantridge. Thus they reached the verge of an incline down which the road stretched in a long straight descent of nearly a mile. Ever since the accident with her father's horse, Tess Durbeyfield, courageous as she naturally was, had been exceedingly timid on wheels. The least irregularity of motion startled her. She began to get uneasy at a certain recklessness in her conductor's driving.
"You will go down slow, sir, I suppose?" she said with attempted unconcern.
Durbeyfield looked round upon her, nipped his cigar with the tips of his large white center teeth, and allowed his lips to smile slowly of themselves.
"Why, Tess," he answered, after another whiff or two, "it isn't a brave bouncing girl like you who asks that.
Why, I always go down at full gallop. There's nothing like it for raising your spirits. But perhaps you need not now?"
"Ah," he said, shaking his head, "there are two to be reckoned with. It is not me alone. Tib has to be considered, and she has a very queer temper."
"Who?"
"Why, this mare." I fancy she looked round at me in a very grim way just then. "Didn't you notice it?"
"Don't try to frighten me, sir," said Tess stiffly.
"Well, I don't. If any living man can manage this horse, I can. I won't say any living man can do it, but if such has the power, I am he."
"Why do you have such a horse?"
"Ah, well may you ask it.
It was my fate, I suppose. Tib has killed one chap, and just after I bought her she nearly killed me. And then, take my word for it, I nearly killed her. But she's touchy still, very touchy, and one's life is hardly safe behind her sometimes." They were just beginning to descend, and it was evident that the horse, whether of her own will or of his, the latter being the more likely, knew so well the reckless performance expected of her that she hardly required a hint from behind. Down, down, they sped, the wheels humming like a top, the dogcart rocking right and left, its axis acquiring a slightly oblique set in relation to the line of progress, the figure of the horse rising and falling in undulations before them. Sometimes a wheel was off the ground, it seemed, for many yards. Sometimes a stone was sent spinning over the hedge, and flinty sparks from the horse's hoofs outshone the daylight. The aspect of the straight road enlarged with their advance, the two banks dividing like a splitting stick, one rushing past at each shoulder. The wind blew through Tess's white muslin to her very skin, and her washed hair flew out behind. She was determined to show no open fear, but she clutched D'Urberville's rein arm.
"Don't touch my arm.
We shall be thrown out if you do. Hold on round my waist." She grasped his waist, and so they reached the bottom.
"Safe, thank God, in spite of your fooling," said she, her face on fire.
"Tess, fie. That's temper," said Durbeyfield.
"'Tis truth."
"Well, you need not let go your hold of me so thanklessly the moment you feel yourself are of danger." She had not considered what she had been doing, whether he were man or woman, stick or stone, in her involuntary hold on him. Recovering her reserve, she sat without replying, and thus they reached the summit of another declivity.
"Now then, again," said Durbeyfield.
"No, no," said Tess. "Show more sense, do, please. But when people find themselves on one of the highest points in the county, they must get down again," he retorted. He loosened rein, and away they went a second time. Durbeyfield turned his face to her as they rocked, and said, in playful raillery, "Now then, put your arms round my waist again, as you did before, my beauty."
"Never,"
said Tess independently, holding on as well as she could without touching him. "Let me put one little kiss on those holmberry lips, Tess, or even on that warm cheek, and I'll stop, on my honor, I will." Tess, surprised beyond measure,
slid farther back still on her seat, at which he urged the horse anew, and rocked her the more.
"Will nothing else do?"
she cried at length, in desperation, her large eyes staring at him like those of a wild animal. This dressing her up so prettily by her mother had apparently been to lamentable purpose.
"Nothing, dear Tess," he replied.
"Oh, I don't know, very well, I don't mind," she panted miserably. He drew rein, and as they slowed he was on the point of imprinting the desired salute, when, as if hardly yet aware of her own modesty, she dodged aside. His arms being occupied with the reins there was left him no power to prevent her maneuver.
"Now, damn it, I'll break both our necks," swore her capriciously passionate companion.
"So you can go from your word like that, you young witch, can you?"
"Very well," said Tess, "I'll not move since you be so determined.
But I thought you would be kind to me, and protect me, as my kinsman."
"Kinsman be hanged. Now.
But I don't want anybody to kiss me, sir," she implored, a big tear beginning to roll down her face, and the corners of her mouth trembling in her attempts not to cry. "And I wouldn't hock him if I had known." He was inexorable, and she sat still, and D'Urberville gave her the kiss of mastery. No sooner had he done so than she flushed with shame, took out her handkerchief, and wiped the spot on her cheek that had been touched by his lips. His ardor was nettled at the sight, for the act on her part had been unconsciously done.
"You are mighty sensitive for a cottage girl," said the young man. Tess made no reply to this remark, of which, indeed, she did not quite comprehend the drift, unheeding the snub she had administered by her instinctive rub upon her cheek. She had, in fact, undone the kiss, as far as such a thing was physically possible. With a dim sense that he was vexed she looked steadily ahead as they trotted on near Melbury Down and Wingreen, till she saw, to her consternation, that there was yet another descent to be undergone.
"You shall be made sorry for that," he resumed, his injured tone still remaining, as he flourished the whip anew.
"Unless, that is, you agree willingly to let me do it again, and no handkerchief."
She sighed. "Very well, sir," she said.
"Oh, let me get my hat."
At the moment of speaking her hat had blown off into the road, their present speed on the upland being by no means slow. D'Urberville pulled up, and said he would get it for her, but Tess was down on the other side. She turned back and picked up the article.
"You look prettier with it off, upon my soul, if that's possible," he said, contemplating her over the back of the vehicle.
"Now then, up again.
What's the matter?"
The hat was in place and tied, but Tess had not stepped forward.
"No, sir," she said, revealing the red and ivory of her mouth as her eyelid in defiant triumph, "not again, if I know it."
"What, you won't get up beside me?"
"No, I shall walk. 'Tis 5 or 6 miles yet to Trantridge. I don't care if 'tis dozens. Besides, the cart is behind."
"You artful hussy.
Now, tell me, didn't you make that hat blow off on purpose?"
"I'll swear you did." Her strategic silence confirmed his suspicion. Then D'Urberville cursed and swore at her, and called her everything he could think of for the trick. Turning the horse suddenly he tried to drive back upon her, and so hem her in between the gig and the hedge. But he could not do this short of injuring her.
"You ought to be ashamed of yourself for using such wicked words," cried Tess with spirit, from the top of the hedge into which she had scrambled.
"I don't like you at all. I hate and detest you. I'll go back to mother, I will." D'Urberville's bad temper cleared up at sight of hers, and he laughed heartily.
"Well, I like you all the better," he said.
"Come, let there be peace. I'll never do it any more against your will. My life upon it now." Still Tess could not be induced to remount. She did not, however, object to his keeping his gig alongside her, and in this manner, at a slow pace, they advanced towards the village of Trantridge. From time to time D'Urberville exhibited a sort of fierce distress at the sight of the tramping he had driven her to undertake by his misdemeanor. She might in truth have safely trusted him now, but he had forfeited her confidence for the time, and she kept on the ground progressing thoughtfully, as if wondering whether it would be wiser to return home. Her resolve, however, had been taken, and it seemed vacillating even to childishness to abandon it now, unless for graver reasons. How could she face her parents, get back her box, and disconcert the whole scheme for the rehabilitation of her family on such sentimental grounds? A few minutes later the chimneys of the slopes appeared in view, and in a snug nook to the right the poultry farm and cottage of Tess' destination. 9 The community of fowls to which Tess had been appointed as supervisor, purveyor, nurse, surgeon, and friend made its headquarters in an old thatched cottage standing in an enclosure that had once been a garden, but was now a trampled and sanded square.
The house was overrun with ivy, its chimney being enlarged by the boughs of the parasite to the aspect of a ruined tower. The lower rooms were entirely given over to the birds, who walked about them with a proprietary air, as though the place had been built by themselves, and not by certain dusty copyholders who now lay east and west in the churchyard. The descendants of these bygone owners felt it almost as a slight to their family when the house which had so much of their affection, had cost so much of their forefathers' money, and had been in their possession for several generations before the D'Urbervilles came and built here, was indifferently turned into a fowl house by Mrs. Stoke D'Urberville as soon as the property fell into hand according to law. 'Twas good enough for Christians in grandfather's time, they said. The rooms wherein dozens of infants had wailed at their nursing now resounded with the tapping of nascent chicks. Distracted hens and coops occupied spots where formerly stood chairs supporting sedate agriculturists. The chimney corner and once blazing hearth was now filled with inverted beehives, in which the hens laid their eggs, while out of doors the plots that each succeeding householder had carefully shaped with a spade were torn by the cocks in wildest fashion. The garden in which the cottage stood was surrounded by a wall, and could only be entered through a door. When Tess had occupied herself about an hour the next morning in altering and improving the arrangements, according to her skilled ideas as the daughter of a professed poulterer, the door in the wall opened and a servant in white cap and apron entered. She had come from the manor house. Mrs. D'Urberville wants the fowls as usual, she said, but perceiving that Tess did not quite understand, she explained, Mrs. is a old lady, and blind.
Blind,
said Tess. Almost before her misgiving at the news could find time to shape itself she took, under her companion's direction, two of the most beautiful of the Hamburgs in her arms, and followed the maidservant, who had likewise taken two, to the adjacent mansion, which, though ornate and imposing, showed traces everywhere on this side that some occupant of its chambers could bend to the love of dumb creatures, feathers floating within view of the front, and hen coops standing on the grass. In a sitting room on the ground floor, ensconced in an armchair with her back to the light, was the owner and mistress of the estate, a white-haired woman of not more than 60, or even less, wearing a large cap. She had the mobile face frequent in those whose sight has decayed by stages, has been laboriously striven after, and reluctantly let go, rather than the stagnant mien apparent in persons long sightless or born blind. Tess walked up to this lady with her feathered charges, one sitting on each arm.
Ah, you are the young woman come to look after my birds? Said Mrs. D'Urberville, recognizing a new footstep. I hope you will be kind to them. My bailiff tells me you are quite the proper person.
Well, where are they?
Ah, this is Strutt.
But he is hardly so lively today, is he? He is alarmed at being handled by a stranger, I suppose. And Fenna too,
yes, they are a little frightened, aren't you, dears? But they will soon get used to you.
While the old lady had been speaking Tess and the other maid, in obedience to her gestures, had placed the fowl severally in her lap, and she had felt them over from head to tail, examining their beaks, their combs, the manes of the cocks, their wings, and their claws. Her touch enabled her to recognize them in a moment, and to discover if a single feather were crippled or draggled. She handled their crops, and knew what they had eaten, and if too little or too much, her face enacting a vivid pantomime of the criticisms passing in her mind. The birds that the two girls had brought in were duly returned to the yard, and the process was repeated till all the pet cocks and hens had been submitted to the old woman, Hamburgs, Bantams, Cochins, Brahmas, Dorkings, and such other sorts as were in fashion just then, her perception of each visitor being seldom at fault as she received the bird upon her knees. It reminded Tess of a confirmation, in which Mrs. D'Urberville was the bishop, the fowls the young people presented, and herself and the maidservant the parson and curate of the parish bringing them up. At the end of the ceremony Mrs. D'Urberville abruptly asked Tess, wrinkling and twitching her face into undulations, "Can you whistle?"
"Whistle, ma'am?"
"Yes, whistle tunes." Tess could whistle like most other country girls, though the accomplishment was one which she did not care to profess in genteel company. However, she blandly admitted that such was the fact.
"Then you will have to practice it every day. I had a lad who did it very well, but he has left. I want you to whistle to my bullfinches, as I cannot see them, I like to hear them, and we teach a mare's that way. Tell her where the cages are, Elizabeth. You must begin tomorrow, or they will go back in their piping. They have been neglected these several days."
Mr. D'Urberville whistled to him this morning, "Ma'am," said Elizabeth. "He.
Pooh."
The old lady's face creased into furrows of repugnance, and she made no further reply. Thus the reception of Tess by her fancied kinswoman terminated, and the birds were taken back to their quarters.
The girl's surprise at Mrs. D'Urberville's manner was not great, for since seeing the size of the house she had expected no more. But she was far from being aware that the old lady had never heard a word of the so-called kinship. She gathered that no great affection flowed between the blind woman and her son. But in that, too, she was mistaken. Mrs. D'Urberville was not the first mother compelled to love her offspring resentfully, and to be bitterly fond. In spite of the unpleasant initiation of the day before, Tess inclined to the freedom and novelty of her new position in the morning when the sun shone, now that she was once installed there, and she was curious to test her powers in the unexpected direction asked of her, so as to ascertain her chance of retaining her post. As soon as she was alone within the walled garden, she sat herself down on a coop, and seriously screwed up her mouth for the long-neglected practice. She found her former ability to have degenerated to the production of a hollow rush of wind through the lips, and no clear note at all. She remained fruitlessly blowing and blowing, wondering how she could have so grown out of the art which had come by nature, till she became aware of a movement among the ivy boughs which cloaked the garden wall no less than the cottage. Looking that way, she beheld the form springing from the coping to the plot. It was Alec D'Urberville, whom she had not set eyes on since he had conducted her the day before to the door of the gardener's cottage where she had lodgings. "Upon my honor," cried he, "there was never before such a beautiful thing in nature or art as you look, Cousin Tess." "Cousin" had a faint ring of mockery. "I have been watching you from over the wall, sitting like impatience on a monument, and patting up that pretty red mouth to whistling shape, and wooing and wooing, and privately swearing, and never being able to produce a note. Why, you are quite cross because you can't do it." "I may be cross, but I didn't swear." "Ah. I understand why you are trying, those bullies. My mother wants you to carry on their musical education. How selfish of her. As if attending to these cursed cocks and hens here were not enough work for any girl. I would flatly refuse, if I were you. But she wants me particularly to do it, and to be ready by tomorrow morning. Does she? Well then, I'll give you a lesson or two." "Oh no, you won't," said Tess, withdrawing towards the door. "Nonsense, I don't want to touch you. See, I'll stand on this side of the wire netting, and you can keep on the other, so you may feel quite safe. Now, look here, you screw up your lips too harshly. There 'tis, so." He suited the action to the word, and whistled a line of "Take, oh take those lips away." But the illusion was lost upon Tess. "Now try," said D'Urberville. She attempted to look reserved, her face put on a sculptural severity. But he persisted in his demand, and at last, to get rid of him, she did put up her lips as directed for producing a clear note, laughing distressfully, however, and then blushing with vexation that she had laughed. He encouraged her with "Try again." Tess was quite serious, painfully serious by this time, and she tried, ultimately and unexpectedly emitting a real round sound. The momentary pleasure of success got the better of her, her eyes enlarged, and she involuntarily smiled in his face. "That's it. Now I have started you, you'll go on beautifully. There, I said I would not come near you, and, in spite of such temptation as never before fell to mortal man, I'll keep my word. Tess, do you think my mother a queer old soul? I don't know much of her yet, sir. You'll find her so, she must be, to make you learn to whistle to her bullfinches. I am rather out of her books just now, but you will be quite in favor if you treat her livestock well. Good morning. If you meet with any difficulties and want help here, don't go to the bailiff, come to me." It was in the economy of this regime that Tess D'Urberville had undertaken to fill a place. Her first day's experiences were fairly typical of those which followed through many succeeding days. A familiarity with Alec D'Urberville's presence, which that young man carefully cultivated in her by playful dialogue, and by jestingly calling her his cousin when they were alone, removed much of her original shyness of him, without, however, implanting any feeling which could engender shyness of a new and tenderer kind. But she was more pliable under his hands than a mere companionship would have made her, owing to her unavoidable dependence upon his mother, and, through that lady's comparative helplessness, upon him. She soon found that whistling to the bullfinches in Mrs. D'Urberville's room was no such onerous business when she had regained the art, for she had caught from her musical mother numerous airs that suited those songsters admirably. A far more satisfactory time than when she practiced in the garden was this whistling by the cages each morning. Unrestrained by the young man's presence, she threw up her mouth, put her lips near the bars, and piped away in easeful grace to the attentive listeners. Mrs. D'Urberville slept in a large four-post bedstead hung with heavy damask curtains, and the bullfinches occupied the same apartment,
where they flitted about freely at certain hours, and made little white spots on the furniture and upholstery. Once while Tess was at the window where the cages were ranged, giving her lesson as usual, she thought she heard a rustling behind the bed. The old lady was not present, and turning round the girl had an impression that the toes of a pair of boots were visible below the fringe of the curtains. Thereupon her whistling became so disjointed that the listener, if such there were, must have discovered her suspicion of his presence. She searched the curtains every morning after that, but never found anybody within them. Alec d'Urberville had evidently thought better of his freak to terrify her by an ambush of that kind. Every village has its idiosyncrasy, its constitution, often its own code of morality. The levity of some of the younger women in and about Trantridge was marked, and was perhaps symptomatic of the choice spirit who ruled the slopes in that vicinity. The place had also a more abiding defect: it drank hard. The staple conversation on the farms around was on the uselessness of saving money, and smock-frocked arithmeticians, leaning on their plows or hoes, would enter into calculations of great nicety to prove that parish relief was a fuller provision for a man in his old age than any which could result from savings out of their wages during a whole lifetime. The chief pleasure of these philosophers lay in going every Saturday night, when work was done, to Chaseborough, a decayed market town 2 or 3 miles distant, and, returning in the small hours of the next morning, to spend Sunday in sleeping off the dyspeptic effects of the curious compound sold to them as beer by the monopolizers of the once independent inns. For a long time Tess did not join in the weekly pilgrimages. But under pressure from matrons not much older than herself, for a field man's wages being as high at 21 as at 40, marriage was early here, Tess at length consented to go. Her first experience of the journey afforded her more enjoyment than she had expected, the hilariousness of the others being quite contagious after her monotonous attention to the poultry farm all the week. She went again and again. Being graceful and interesting, standing moreover on the momentary threshold of womanhood, her appearance drew down upon her some sly regards from loungers in the streets of Chaseborough. Hence, though sometimes her journey to the town was made independently, she always searched for her fellows at nightfall, to have the protection of their companionship homeward. This had gone on for a month or two when there came a Saturday in September, on which a fair and a market coincided, and the pilgrims from Trantridge saw double delights at the inns on that account. Tess's occupations made her late in setting out, so that her comrades reached the town long before her. It was a fine September evening, just before sunset, when yellow lights struggle with blue shades in hair-like lines, and the atmosphere itself forms a prospect without aid from more solid objects, except the innumerable winged insects that dance in it. Through this low-lit mistiness Tess walked leisurely along. She did not discover the coincidence of the market with the fair till she had reached the place, by which time it was close upon dusk. Her limited marketing was soon completed, and then as usual she began to look about for some of the Trantridge cottagers. At first she could not find them, and she was informed that most of them had gone to what they called a private little jig at the house of a hay trusser and peat dealer who had transactions with their farm. He lived in an out-of-the-way nook of the townlet, and in trying to find her course thither her eyes fell upon Mr. d'Urberville standing at a street corner. "What, my beauty? You here so late?" he said. She told him that she was simply waiting for company homeward. "I'll see you again," said he over her shoulder as she went on down the back lane. Approaching the hay trussers, she could hear the fiddled notes of a reel proceeding from some building in the rear, but no sound of dancing was audible, an exceptional state of things for these parts, where as a rule the stamping drowned the music. The front door being open she could see straight through the house into the garden at the back as far as the shades of night would allow, and nobody appearing to her knock, she traversed the dwelling and went up the path to the outhouse whence the sound had attracted her. It was a windowless erection used for storage, and from the open door there floated into the obscurity a mist of yellow radiance, which at first Tess thought to be illuminated smoke. But on drawing nearer she perceived that it was a cloud of dust, lit by candles within the outhouse, whose beams upon the haze carried forward the outline of the doorway into the wide night of the garden. When she came close and looked and she beheld indistinct forms racing up and down to the figure of the dance, the silence of their footfalls arising from their being over shoe and scroff, that is to say, the powdery residuum from the storage of peat and other products, the stirring of which by their turbulent feet created the nebulosity that involved the scene. Through this floating, fusty debris of peat and hay, mixed with the perspirations and warmth of the dancers, and forming together a sort of vegeto-human pollen, the muted fiddles feebly pushed their notes, in marked contrast to the spirit with which the measure was trodden out. They coughed as they danced, and laughed as they coughed.